Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Before we begin this jam-packed episode, I want to let you know we won't be putting on an episode next week for the 4th of July. So we hope you have a happy and healthy holiday weekend. Maybe you're taking some time off. I will take some time off the week after the 4th of July, but we will have a podcast for you on that Friday. In this episode, which is brought to you by our good friends at Protolabs, we will speak with Rachel Ellingson. Rachel is the Chief Strategy and Corporate Development Officer at Solventum, and we spoke at during Device Talks Minnesota toward the end of the day. Rachel and I, as you'll hear, had talked a few times via Zoom, but like everybody else, it's always a treat when you get to meet the person in person. So we will review where Solventum is at, what Rachel's role is, what are the challenges and the opportunities presented by being spun out and by spinning others out. She's been on both ends of that transaction. So I really enjoyed that conversation and perspective from Rachel. After that, Kayleen Brown, our fantastic managing editor, has a conversation with Athar Mirza. He is the Vice President of Global Infusion Systems at Baxter International. This, of course, is part of our Future of MedTech Opportunities series. Yes, our FOMO series. So make sure you enjoy, I'm sure you'll enjoy that conversation. Once again, brought to you by Protolabs. And finally, of course, we have our Newmarkers Newsmakers. Chris Newmarker and I are joined by Associate Editor Sean Hooley, who had spent the week covering the American Diabetes Association annual meeting, did a great job posting news on Mass Device and Drug Delivery Business News. We'll talk with Sean about the week's non-diabetes stories, but then we'll spend a good long time unpacking ADA and some of the cool things he saw. It's definitely one of the more dynamic sectors within medtech. Before we begin this conversation, though, I want to let you know that we will be meeting on July 8th for Device Talks Tuesdays. Our good friends at Maxon are putting a presentation called Robotic Joints and Haptics. Because I'll be on vacation, I won't be hosting that conversation, but Kayleen Brown will be there, and she'll do a great job as she did this week with our good friends at Integer. So make sure you go to devicetalks.com to register for that conversation. You can watch it live, get your questions answered right away, or watch it on demand and can still get your questions answered. Just might take a little bit longer. Go to devicetalks.com to register for that. And we'll be posting details about the Device Talks West agenda very soon. So keep an eye out for that at west.devicetalks.com. And that's it, folks. Let's get this podcast episode started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. How are you doing?
Doing well. You know what Monday is, Chris?
What?
It's my birthday.
Oh, man. Happy birthday. Mm-hmm.
June 30th, baby.
So you're a Cancer?
I am a Cancer. in many ways. I destroy cultures, but I also have the traits that I guess would go along. I don't know what I'm going to ask a question that you may not know the answer to. What are the traits of a Cancer?
I should know that.
If you don't know this, that's okay. Like, this isn't your sweet spot.
But I mean, our kids actually have that zodiac sign, like our twin boy and girl. So, okay. At least this is according to Google's AI that I just asked.
Never wrong.
That it's emotional depth, mm-hmm. strong.
Check.
Intuition.
Check.
A nurturing nature.
Hell yeah, I nurture.
That's what I think. I mean,
I am Cancer all day long.
I think anyone who listens to this podcast feels nurtured. I wondered if I was alone, but I listen to this Device Talks Weekly with these, you know, goofy guys, and you know, I feel like I'm not alone now.
What's your zodiac sign, Chris? What's your
I'm a Gemini, man. I just had my birthday like just a week and a half ago. So.
Oh, really? How did we not know that?
Isn't that great? We both got June. I mean, actually, no, you got July early, wait.
June 30th. We're both June. Yeah.
We're both June.
Yeah, but my mom was a Gemini. She was June 18th. So there's that, the line is right there. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. And what are the traits of a Gemini?
What are the traits of a Gemini? I think we're supposed to be gregarious. I mean, that's usually, yes, curious, communicative.
Mm-hmm. Check.
Intellectual.
Very.
Wow.
Whoa. There's something to all this.
There might be something to this.
So we have our guest today, Sean Hooley, associate
Sean's
editor.
A Libra?
Sean, what's your sign?
I am a Libra, September 27th. Yeah.
Look it up. What's a Libra traits, Chris?
I started Googling the traits while you guys were talking. You got it is diplomacy, fairness, and love of balance.
Oh, yeah.
However, that screams Sean Hooley. Uh-oh.
Desire for peace can sometimes lead to indecisiveness.
Whoa.
Well, Chris and I will have a fight.
Decisive.
And we'll see what, we'll stage a fight to see how Sean reacts.
I'm decisive until you've never seen me try and pick a restaurant to order takeout from.
You're like, I'll take, do I get the beef and broccoli or do I get the Kung Pao chicken?
Now, are you, last bit of non-med tech, are you guys, if you're going out to eat, are you going to a restaurant that you know and love, or are you let's try a new place kind of people? I'm a know and love. Like, if I get a place, like, I'm going there until I don't, like, until I can't. Yourselves?
I probably lean more familiarity than anything, but I don't mind trying a new place.
Oh, I don't mind it either, but if I'm, like, going out and spending the money, I'm like, I want to, I guess I hate, like, going out and having a bad restaurant experience. It really upsets me. Chris Newmarker?
We like trying new places, but we always, like, do a lot of research, like Google, like Google ratings, Yelp, like what's, like, generally if something isn't 5 stars, I don't want to waste my time, you know, because
I've lived long enough. Whoa, look at Chris
Newmarker. Lived long enough that I don't need to waste my time on a bad meal, like, that's right. Like, you know, maybe we're desperate, we'll do a 4-star.
But, you call know, this like, a $300 bottle of champagne? Get it out of here! I gargle with this stuff at home.
Yeah, this is my mouthwash.
All right. So we've unpacked all the important stuff. I guess we should roll.
I've never asked a waiter to take a bottle of wine back. I should maybe someday. I need to check that box someday.
I don't order bottles of wine frequently because my wife doesn't drink that much. I have sent a glass of wine back just because I was like, you know what?
You just like.
Because a good waiter will be like, they'll see me drink it and make the face. And they're like, are you happy? I'm like, actually, no. Could I have the Syrah? And they said, sure, no problem. Yeah. And the fellow next to me was like, whoa, look at you. I'm like, it's a glass of wine. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to just drink it if I don't like it. Like, you know, they got more in the back. They're fine.
It tastes like barrel swill. You're like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I like a red. All right.
Good red. Yeah.
So.
All right.
We got a chock full of Newmarker's newsmakers. Totally. So we've did all of our astrology section of this podcast is done with.
Yes, our listeners are like, could you guys just stop and stop wasting our time?
Our last listener is like, this better be worth it.
Tom, are we going to do our Chinese zodiac signs now?
No, next
year. I'm the year of the dragon.
We'll save that. We don't want to. Okay. We don't want to give them too much good stuff. In
one
episode.
There you go. All right.
So what is number five, Chris?
We've got the Newmarker's newsmakers.
Yeah.
So, all right. Number five, we've got this is, the name of the company is Science Corporation. They're brain computer interface developer, and they were founded by a Neuralink co-founder. Max Hodak, I hope I pronounced that right, Max, but Max left Neuralink and started this company, and they had regulatory news this week that they submitted their Prima retinal implant for CE mark approval. And this story, by the way, is by Sean here. Sean, what struck you the most about this story?
Mainly that it's just a slightly different seemingly application of BCI. You know, we've seen a lot of movement restoring or sort of the ability to control a computer with your thoughts or that type of thing. This one is more, this is a vision restoration system. The company says it's trying to bring to market the first BCI to restore functional form vision to patients blinded with late stage macular degeneration. So their examples were that in European trials, patients were able to recognize playing cards, fill in crossword puzzles, things like that. So definitely a bit different than the BCIs we've covered, and seemingly works, and they think it's ready for commercial efforts in Europe. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I mean, Elon says a lot of different things, and I know I recall like with Neuralink, there's been talk like, oh, we were gonna have some kind of vision application with it, but yeah, this says something that they got something that they're actually, you know, submitting for regulatory approval in Europe. So
yeah, this struck me because two things. One, retinitis pigmentosa is in my family. An uncle I've never met who lives in Argentina had it. I know that growing up. Wow. So it was always in my mind that, you know, unfortunately, I'm fine. So, but it's always something I'm looking for. Secondly, it reminded me of how far we've come, because 10 years ago, we were talking about the company Second Sight, which had a vision restorative system, but it was goggles, and I think there's like a pack you had to carry along, and all it really brought you was really kind of pixelated images of light and shadow. So, you know, for someone who's blind, certainly helps to be able to see, you know, light versus shadow. But here we are 10 years later, and now we're talking about a BCI and potentially doing the same thing. That's really remarkable.
Yeah, totally. It's amazing how, like, technology is advancing. So that should hopefully give people some hope.
All right, well, that's a great number five, Chris Newmarker. What is number four?
Well, number four, we had, you know, this is another story from Sean here. You know, Sean's just rolling these stories out. Yeah, I know, right? You know, so number four, we've got a FDA sent out an alert to health providers that they were, warning about, you know, they've issued import alerts to prevent future shipments of about 58 devices made by Olympus in Japan, and their stock in Tokyo is down more than 13% this week on the news. You know, Sean, I recall like in your story, I mean, Olympus has, I mean, they've kind of had, this is something that goes back before the current administration. They've had this whole series of challenges that they've been trying to work through with FDA related to their Japanese manufacturing, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, this is the first issue with this specific site, which is Aizu, for any mispronunciation, site in Japan. They had a warning letter in 2023 related to adulterated endoscopes following a Tokyo inspection, and it had received two separate letters at the end of 2022 as well. So yeah, they've definitely been The FDA has been dealing with some issues with Olympus for a while, and it seems that they just want to put a stop to bringing in any potentially, you know, poorly manufactured devices at this moment.
There's like a whole array of endoscopes here. I mean, these are like, you know, bronchoscopes, laparoscopes, automated endoscope reprocessors. I mean, Bob White, the longtime Medtronic executive, took over as CEO of Olympus. So, here's to hoping that, he can get this, fixed soon, you know, and they can, get some better things going over at Olympus.
Good hire. I think one well received by the industry, and I think folks are excited to see where Olympus goes, and I'm sure these will get smoothed out in time. So, all right. Good job. Number four, Chris Newmarker. What's number three?
Hey, number three, we've got Johnson & Johnson Vision. They launched their AccuView Oasys Max multifocal lens. I mean, this is for astigmatism, but, neat thing about this was J&J was, saying that with this launch, they've got what they're saying is the first complete family of daily disposable contact lenses for people with astigmatism. I mean, it's actually been a really interesting business over at J&J. They've had a lot of innovation over the years. There was a lot of excitement a few years ago when they had antihistamine eluting contact lenses to help out people who, you know, have allergies and also need to wear contact lenses. Just very, really cool news. And, you know, actually these types of stories get some attention on Mass Device. People are there's actually a lot of innovation, you know, taking place in that whole contact lens space. And I'm actually have reached out to J&J to get we're hoping to get the head of the chair of their vision business onto this podcast in coming weeks to talk some more about it. I'm really excited.
No, that'll be great. The ophthalmology space is always an exciting one. Obviously, very heavily consumer, and also the ophthalmologists are just lovers of technology, fast adopters of technology, and J&J is always at the forefront with this, with these things. And I'm eager to hear that conversation that might happen with the head of J&J Vision. So, all right. Chris Neuberger, what is
a little bit about the vision at J&J Vision?
Boom! Yes,
there we go.
Were puns part of the Gemini character trait? I don't think so. No,
wittiness maybe.
You got that in spades, my friend. What's number two on the newsmaker?
Number two on the list. This is another one from Sean here.
Oh my God!
I know Sean's just cranking them out. I mean, my gosh. You know, we have actually this is some really interesting news. Robert Cohen. Is moving to another position at Stiles. I mean, Cohen's been president of Stryker's Digital Robotics Enabling Technologies organization. I've seen him at a number of shows speak, you know, including our Device Talks show. Just always a really, really just, you know, interesting innovator in the industry to listen to. So it's definitely, and he came over to Stryker with, you know, the Mako acquisition years ago that kind of really set Stryker up, you know, to really change the game really in the orthopedic surgery space, you know, with, you know, kind of like this orthosurgical robotics technology. So just some interesting news. I mean, what did you make of it, Tom? You had some thoughts on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I know for sure. As you said, he was at Device Talks Boston a couple of years ago, and I remember he was just extraordinary on a panel and line of people, like a CEO length line of people wanting to talk with him after the talk. So very well regarded in the industry. In the release and Rob's LinkedIn post, you know, suggested he's just stepping back a bit, which would make sense. He's probably at a point in his career where he, you know, he's looking to simplify. So I think you want to read into anything into news like this, you especially with Stryker and talking about surgical robotics, like you want the next shoe to be like, oh, and following this appointment, it led to the acquisition of such, but I'm not sure if that's the case. I mean, Cohen,
you know, he's going to transition to being vice president of innovation and technology and orthopedics.
Right, yeah.
And then we've got Mike Carlin, you know, who has been at Stryker, is moving into this role then with digital robotics and enabling technologies. But hard to read right now exactly if that signals anything, or as you said, I mean, it could just be, like Robert Cohen's like got to a point where he's kind of, simplifying things a bit, and you know, they're moving somebody new into this role at Stryker.
Yeah, and it could be both. It could just be, you know, they also wanted to broaden the exposure of the person in that position. And Mike Carlin had been president of customer solutions for Stryker, which is a position that I don't see very often, and not sure if I entirely understand the responsibilities, but he certainly from his perch had a more holistic view of all of Stryker's businesses. So one could say that maybe they're de-emphasizing the ortho and putting emphasis on their surgical business and other areas, and that could be another reason why this is taking place. Or again, maybe Robert just wanted to step aside, and Stryker said, "You know what? We've got a person with a great view of the entire device universe. Let's put them in charge of digital DRE, and reap the benefits later on. Because I mean, they're as Andy Pierce said at Device Talks West, they are kicking tires. They are keeping in touch. They're following surgical robotics companies. So I mean, it's not a matter of if; it's a matter of when. And maybe this makes the when happen sooner. We'll see."
Yeah, they've had this kind of door kind of a bit open, like, hey, we might branch into soft tissue surgical robotics, but at the same time, they kind of also said they're taking their time on this. They're not, like, going to just go and buy a robotic surgery company. But
I think Andy said they follow companies for, like, at least 5 years before pulling triggers, so they may have a lot of pots that are simmering on the stove. So
yeah,
we'll see which one boils over first.
So number one, you know, we just about a week ago wrapped up the American Diabetes Association scientific sessions in Chicago. A ton of news came out of it, and Sean here was in Chicago for all of it. If you haven't checked it out already on drug delivery business news and Mass Device, Sean has a great roundup of the biggest diabetes tech stories out of ADA 2025, and we're gonna be actually keep your eyes out on those two sites in mid July, because that roundup and some other really good stories are gonna be. Included in a diabetes tech special report that Sean has put together. And, you know, I'm actually working through the draft right now. And I mean, it's just some really good information, good stuff that Sean here has put together. It's fantastic. But Sean, tell us some more about like what you thought the highlights were like at the ADA show when you were there. What surprised you the most?
Well, and one more plug for the diabetes special report is, it'll also have a list of the 10 largest diabetes tech companies in the world, so keep an eye out for that as well. But yeah, the ADA was busy, but you know, quite interesting. Had a lot of meetings with a lot of the big companies, and some of the big takeaways, I suppose, were speaking to Abbott about their upcoming dual glucose ketone sensor. That's sort of generated a lot of buzz. There's already been automated insulin delivery pump makers partnering with Abbott to get ready to integrate that, and it's not even on the market yet. That's probably coming next year. So there's a lot of interest in that, as well as their Medtronic partnership. Obviously, Medtronic separating its diabetes unit, but it's still operating, you know, business as usual at the moment. Some new data on MiniMed and some interesting tidbits on some next generation pumps came out of the conference as well. Spoke with Tandem, Insulet, Dexcom, got a lot of, you know, interesting stuff there. One of the coolest bits from the conference for me was seeing the PharmaSense and Cybionics pump up front and personal. It was, they announced just before the conference that they partnered to create an all-in-one system. So there's actually a CGM built into the pump, and the two needles next to each other, one delivers insulin, the other measures the interstitial fluid to get the glucose readings. And it's quite an interesting system. It's different from anything out there right now. I think it's still, you know, not necessarily
ready
close
for prime
to the market. Yeah. We'll see how long that takes and what comes of it, but definitely an innovative thing there.
Yeah, because I mean, generally, like, you've had to have like a CGM sensor and the pump. I mean, that's what we've seen with these combos, you know, and this is kind of like a single device that does both of it at the same time, which is
Very cool. One of my favorite sort of pictures in our archive is we have a picture of someone who's wearing an Omnipod and a Dexcom G6 on either side of their abdomen. So you can see them right next to each other, but they are different devices. And so this is quite different, and it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You did, as I said on LinkedIn, I think an exceptional job. When someone's covering a meeting well, you almost feel like you're there. Like I could, as you were writing about stuff, I could kind of imagine you watching these things happen. So I thought the coverage was outstanding. I know you had some talk about Sequel MedTech, which we had on the podcast recently. That seems like another cool company as well.
Their launch is coming up soon with the Abbott Libre, so that'll be a big deal. And Sequel Twist is definitely, last year they were generating all the buzz because they were brand new and nobody really quite knew what to make of it. And now
Dean Kamen is involved. And so what, I mean, these articles were on Mass Device and on Drug Delivery Business News, so folks should certainly check those out. What didn't make the pages there, Sean? Anything maybe that wasn't article worthy, or didn't fit an article, but you kind of walked away thinking that's one of the coolest things I've seen?
Well, I will say there are articles on some of these topics in terms of, you know, there was some coverage of posters and but some, you know, interesting stuff that maybe didn't quite generate the bigger headlines was, you know, GLP-1s have sort of been a hot topic for a few years now, but they've almost folded into just normalcy in a way where we're not talking about them as much as like this crazy new drug. It's just a thing. And now we're looking at different ways to deliver them. So we saw Modular Medical, which makes a wearable manual insulin patch pump, you know, not automated. They had a poster study sharing the use of the pump technology to deliver GLP-1s that sort of backed, you know, early days, but backed this is a potential way to deliver. And for needle phobia, for different, you know, methods of delivery, for different volumes of delivery, these things can always, you know, provide alternatives. Vaxess as well makes shelf-stable vaccine delivery patches. They looked into GLP-1 as well. So those are both on Drug Delivery Business News as coverage of the posters. But I would recommend people, you know, look into those. One of the other stories that was interesting, and I got to sit down with the BioLink team, and I haven't, you know, quite been able to turn that into a longer form story or anything like that, but they're creating an intradermal sensor, but it's a little bit different than the generic CGMs on the market, and they actually looked into the sensor in detecting muscle loss, so preventing that muscle loss during GLP-1 therapy. There's a lot of people who are, you know, losing weight on GLP-1s are also losing muscle. And so it's a way to track that now, potentially with this. Well, it's initially intended to be a glucose monitor, but they're showing that it can, you know, monitor a whole host of things. So definitely some, you know, maybe less favored headlines. There's a lot of big names that you know, get all the buzz, but these were some interesting stories.
What you said about the GLP-1s is interesting, because you're right. Like a year or two ago, there's a lot of like, oh, our GLP-1s just going to, you know, could they cure diabetes? I mean, people stop having, you know, type 2 diabetes because, you know, they use them, and then we're not going to need all this technology, you know, and it seems like we've moved a lot more to a place where it's like, I mean, these drugs seem to do some amazing things. However, people, you know, who use them then really want to be monitoring themselves and, you know, figuring some stuff out, you know, for the long run. And so, you know, there's a place for this med tech and GLP-1s to work together. And it was also interesting in recent days that there was like a jump in the stocks of all of these diabetes tech companies, just because RFK Jr. like kind of was saying like, well, I mean, these sensors are a lot more affordable than the GLP-1s. So, you know, like, why don't we make these sensors more, for, you know, accessible to people? So that was interesting as well.
And one of the big things, I think, when the GLP-1 buzz first hit was people were worried that diabetes tech was going to take a hit because GLP-1s were suddenly going to be this cure-all, when in reality, you know, both the pump makers and CGM makers said, no, this can work in tandem with our systems. So at the time, they were saying, you know, people are still going to need insulin, people are still going to need to monitor glucose. So that, you know, sort of allayed any fears at the moment. And then now they're even looking at, oh, we can actually, you know, deliver these even. So
yeah,
it was funny you mentioned the BioLink story. That was the one that I kind of happened upon first when I was reading your stuff, and I was going to post about that, and then I'm like, wait, this is good too, and this is good too, and that's why I ultimately did a post with five of my favorite articles. But that one I thought was appealing because, you know, we talk about Dexcom and its move into sort of the ultra fitness category. I mean, you could see BioLink developing something as well, with folks who are tracking every measurable metric of their body, wanting to know where they're gaining muscle, where they're losing fat, really moving into that as well. So cool.
The sensor is cool too, because they have actual LED like display on the set. You know, there's little you can see sort of alerts or little things like that that is not quite available on the other sensors at the moment. So something new, something different.
Yeah, that's a very good. They were at Device Talks West last year. I remember Jim Hammer and I had a call with them, and you get on these calls thinking like, all right, here we go, another technology, and then they start showing, you're like, oh wow, like this is really cool. Like, okay, then you get excited. Sean, you've been covering ADA, I think, for a couple of years now. I've seen, like, when you cover a clinical meeting year after year after year, and this is not a new one, obviously, this is an older one, but are you sensing any sort of, are the exhibits bigger? Is there more, like, is diabetes like becoming, did this year's feel any different than past years, or is it sort of remaining stable?
Yeah, this is the only the second year I've been in person, so still a very, you know, small frame of reference.
Yeah.
But I actually, this was the first year, I believe, since pre-COVID that it was held, you know, entirely in person. Like, they've sort of done the virtual in-person split, and this was meant to be entirely in person. And I did see one person sort of suggest that the conference used to be, you know, in previous iterations, I mean, this is the 85th, but back in the day, it was, you know, you're here to present about your insulin, your drug, your therapeutic, things like that. It was really pharma heavy. And they said that they've noticed the shift towards tech and device. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, some of the biggest exhibits there are Abbott, Dexcom, Medtronic, Insulet. You know, they have the biggest booths, they have the biggest space. You little walk around, see the tours, show, get, little demos of the device, things like that. So I do think that diabetes is headed and just, it always has been for the most part headed in that direction of device. And something I referenced when I talked to Trang Lai, the Insulet chief medical officer, I referenced something from our 2022 Device Talks Boston when Eric Benjamin said that they lived at the intersection of medtech and consumer. And, you know, Insulet just hired Ashley McAvoy, who has a consumer history in terms of her experience. So it's definitely something that they're all looking at as, you know, we want to cater the consumer. Obviously, the over-the-counter glucose monitors as well from Abbott and Dexcom have suddenly, you know, changed the game in terms of I can order a CGM on Amazon, which is not probably something people thought they could do even 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. No, very true. And I think it's a model probably for more of medtech, in that the patients, the people with diabetes are the most informed patient group, I think, and can make those decisions that are right for them and can discern which sensor is best for them. And I think it's only going to serve patients and industry better going forward. So great job covering it. Yeah. So really, really, really well done. And great wrap up too on the podcast. So thanks so much.
Fantastic.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris Neumarker and Sean Hooley for unpacking the week's news. Now let's get into our FOMO interview of the episode. Once again, Kayleen Brown speaks with Athar Mirzer, the VP of Global Infusion Systems at Baxter International. We had this conversation, which is sponsored by Protolabs, recorded at our Device Talks Boston studio. Let's listen.
Athar Mirzer, Vice President, Global Infusion Systems for Baxter International. Thank you for joining me on the Future of MedTech series, and we're going to discuss the future of connected health.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I know I've gotten the privilege of getting to know you and better understanding how Baxter International works with connected health. But what I don't really know is, why are you interested in connected health? So like, how did your journey lead you here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I started off working at a company in the lab. It's called LabCorp. And we were focused on laboratory information systems. So this was very early on, when we were able to send lab results to our customers and to their patients. So customers can quickly look at lab results and make decisions. From there, I actually worked at a healthcare system and I implemented an Epic EMR. And from there, I got a significant amount of experience at looking at how healthcare is delivered and the influence technology has on improving the patient's outcome. And then from there, moved to Baxter and have been working on infusion pumps for the last 14 years. I've been at Baxter 14 years and really focused on how the device connects to the EMRs. As you think about an infusion pump, actually, as you think about devices at the bedside, the infusion pump is likely the most critical device. That's the device that's changing the patient's condition. A lot of other devices are monitoring them. And so making sure that's connected can significantly improve patient care and the way that delivery is handled. And so that's been a passion of mine I've been in healthcare for 25 years. I've been working on connected care for 25 years. Baxter has, and we talked about this earlier, about 1.5 million devices connected globally. Tons of information, tons of data on those devices, and making sure we can get those to our caregivers is, one, it's fun. Two, it's exciting, and I think we can pave a road ahead of us.
Oh, I love that so much. So I didn't realize that you were in medtech for 25 years.
Yeah.
I'm coming on my 19th year in medtech. And I think historically, traditionally, when you think of medtech, you think of kind of implantable devices, something you can hold. And I remember when digital health came in, and that was the big, big buzzword. And I think that has really evolved to what it actually is, which is connected health. Did you always see that you can't have just one device without having a connection? Like, did you feel like it always needed to be this full circle for the best outcomes?
Yeah. So when you think about the acute care space, there are anywhere up to 15 devices that are connected to a patient. And it's not just one caregiver. It's a broad caregiving team. And so the information all those devices have influence the outcome of the patient. And so aggregating all that data, aggregating all that information and presenting it to the caregiving team in a meaningful way, allowing them to make decisions, I think to answer your question is going to drive a lot of what we're going to see here in healthcare. The second piece of that is how do we personalize that? How do we automate that? So creating devices to talk to each other. So they're balancing each other out. If a patient's glucose level goes up, how does that affect the way the infusion pump reacts? I think you're going to see a lot more of that in healthcare. So it is moving away from an implantable device to all the devices that are at the bedside to treat that patient.
Well, extremely well said. And from my history in medtech, it's actually one of the most exciting times, I think, in medtech, because you can really see the change that connected health has provided for from the clinician to industry to the patient, of course. It's really been so impactful. I see it as such a positive thing, but there has to be challenges.
Yeah.
So what, from your perspective, are the current challenges when it comes to connected health today?
Yeah, I think it's change management. Actually, there's two that I would say. One is ensuring that manufacturers are working with each other to create that meaningful story on the patient. And so it can't just be done by Baxter alone. You know, we want to work with other manufacturers to bring that comprehensive story for that patient. So I think that's a bit of a challenge that we continue to work through. The second one is just compliance or change management. So, you know, what's working today is working really well. As we look towards the future and try to progress healthcare, it makes people uncomfortable. It makes, organizations uncomfortable. It's our job to, one, give them comfort and make it cost effective as well. I think what you see driving a lot of the implementation and adoption of technology is improving patient outcomes, limiting nursing turnover, and automating healthcare as much as we can. So I think you're going to see, I think those risks are there. And I think over time, you'll see people get more comfortable with it and adopt it.
So do you see this as the three examples that you gave me? I mean, that's, in a way, how the industry is responding to the challenges already. Do you see any other ways that industry is responding to these main challenges, you know, to bring that comfort, that security?
Yeah, I think it's up to the manufacturer to make sure they have a easy to use device, a device that's easy to implement, and that's connected to their system, not just to our portion of our devices. I think those are critical. You know, I think about, you know, we talk about diabetes and, you know, it went from a finger stick to now there's a continuous glucose monitor. There's still people out there that won't wear a continuous glucose monitor because they just don't know how to use it. They're uncomfortable with the technology. So it's up to the manufacturer to make sure they are, our healthcare organizations understand what we have and it's easy to implement. And I think that will then drive adoption and further use.
That makes a lot of sense, especially the way we think about sort of innovation moving forward iteratively. And I loved the example you just used. Are there any other ways that maybe the industry is responding using this example specifically that might help move that needle or might help innovate in the short term? So bring that patient who maybe doesn't know how to use it, now feels comfortable using it, now has the education to use it. Is there another in-between step that we could do to bring that innovation where it needs to be today?
Yeah, part of our design process, I will answer your question in making sure it's easy to use. And so the way we make it easy to use is we do extensive human factors testing. We do extensive voice of customer to make sure that that product, as it's implemented, it's adopted. A lot of times what we see is minimizing the workarounds. So if we're rolling out a device, nurses, clinicians will find a workaround. They're comfortable with what they use. They're comfortable with how it works. But providing them value on top of their current workflow, I think, can help increase and drive more adoption. So I think that, to me, would be the in-between before we get to the Holy Grail.
That's very encouraging. So we are talking about, you know, the future of connected health. You and I both know, and everybody in this room knows, that technology is accelerating at such a rapid rate that when we say future, I mean, I could be talking about next week.
Yeah.
It's pretty unbelievable in that way. So maybe we talk about the future of connected health, just as I mentioned, kind of iteratively. So a year from now, what do you hope to see? What do you think we will see when it comes to connected health this time next year?
I think you will see more AI use in healthcare. And we see it today. It's predominantly non-clinical. So scheduling, billing, where I think we would be in 1 to 3 years, and we are leading the way in this, Baxter is leading the way in this, is being able to use AI to make clinical decisions. Have our healthcare providers have a support system using a national database and algorithm that allows them to make better decisions for the patient, but still giving them the autonomy to make that decision. I think you should see that in the next 1 to 3 years.
What about, so it was 1 year, 2, 3 years, what about decades?
I think if I were to talk about what Baxter's vision is and where I would be happy in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years, is clinicians spending more time with the patient than doing ancillary work, and using technology and innovation to automate those other items that they were working on and get them back to the bedside. So I'd say in the next 5 years, we'd like to see that. And that's measurable today. I think right now a clinician thinks about 30% of their time with the patient. We can change that. We can have a direct impact on that. And that's really what our vision is. And so all the things that we built, the AI, the integration, the automation, it's really driving towards that.
Many people have heard me say many times that, from my perspective, artificial intelligence is allowing humans to be more human.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting the same essence from you, that if we can maybe flip that statistic, so clinicians are with patients 70% of the time.
That's exactly it.
Can we just imagine how different the clinician and patient relationship might be? How different the way we approach care. I mean, the opportunities around that are absolutely limitless, and it's really exciting.
It is.
Maybe sort of last question, still thinking about the future, and you can frame it through the lens of Baxter or frame it through your own personal hope. But for you, if you had a dream big, bigger than we can even imagine, what could connected health be? Or, you know, we talked about digital health to connected health. Like, what could that next step be in 20 years, 50 years? Like, what could that be? Is there even something?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing now is more care at home. And I think there's a level of comfort. There's studies out there that people recover faster. And so if I were to think about, you know, next 10, 20, 30 years, obviously making sure there's not as many sick people, people are living longer, they're living healthier lives, but getting in front of that before they get sick. And so, you know, I think about healthcare at the home and getting patients treated there, because there is information, there are connected devices, everyone has a Wi-Fi at their house, and that's doable. And so being able to, for patients to get taken care of at home versus having to go into an acute care facility, I think we'll see that down the road. We are seeing care move in that direction. But one, being proactive, and I think more care there, it's called hospital at home. I think we're going to start seeing that more and more.
Being able to treat more patients, bring care to the patient. And that's really exciting.
It's huge. It's huge.
Well, I have loved every second with you, as I always do. So thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
And I'm going to connect with you a year from now, and we'll see what's coming true.
Hold me accountable. That's good.
So thanks again for joining
us
on the Future of.
Yep. I appreciate it.
Once again, thanks to Protolabs for sponsoring this FOMO. Now we're going to have our conversation with Rachel Ellingson. Again, I spoke with Rachel at our Device Talks Minnesota meeting. She is the Chief Strategy and Corporate Development Officer at Solventum. When we talked previously, she was Chief Strategy Officer at Zimmer Biomet, and then joined Brian Hansen when he left Zimmer Biomet to take the helm at Solventum. So at Zimmer Biomet, she was responsible, oversaw the spin out of the ZimV franchise. So she was at Zimmer Biomet when they spun out a large entity. Now she's at Solventum, which of course spun out of 3M, and she is taking a spun out entity and charting a new course. So very interesting perspective, great conversation, and it was fantastic to meet Rachel. Let's listen.
Can you hear me?
You can.
I can hear you, yes. All right. Well, Rachel Ellingson, it's nice to meet you, finally.
Well, I feel like I've met you. We had a podcast a year and a half.
We've had a few Zoom calls, but I've had a lot of those experiences today where it's like,
3D.
We both kind of look at each other like, you look different than you do in my tiny laptop. So this is great.
Well, thanks for having me, by the way. I do appreciate the opportunity. And lots changed since we last talked.
You were with a different company. Same role, different company, but now you're here. And it's a perfect perfect conversation for this venue, Device Talks Minnesota. And we definitely wanted to learn where Solventum is headed. But first, of course, we always like to understand a little bit about our guests. And talk a bit about your career path and how it led us to Solventum. And we did do a podcast. So if folks want the whole How I Got Into MedTech story, which is my typical question, you can find our podcast. And I do remember that you were a psychology major, right?
Wow, you have a really good memory. I wasn't going to go back that far to start.
Oh, yeah.
But yes.
This is your life. Here's your professor. No, I'm just kidding. Brought you to here today?
Sure. Well, starting back, I won't go so far back as to college. I will say my career path has been pretty much two chapters, I think of it. I think of investment banking as my first 15 years, and then the rest of that has been as a med tech executive. And I'd say the two things that have been true throughout that journey have been a commitment and passion for healthcare. I've always, even as an investment banker, I was very focused on the healthcare sector and on med tech specifically for most of that career. And then this idea of, we talked about this a little before, but this idea of just liking to learn new things, right? It's just that curiosity. And I think if you look at my route, investment banking, I would say pretty traditional investment banking. I started at a small firm doing M&A, but then decided, I've been doing M&A for a while. This firm doesn't really do a lot of equity deals. Let me go to a bigger one that does more equity deals so I can learn about IPOs and different things. And then ended my career at Bank of America, or is able to do larger, more complex deals and leverage their balance sheet. So always trying to look for those different twists and turns. And then decided to leave investment banking, loved it as a career, but really thought that just trying to understand how the decisions were made on the inside, right? So how I was working on all these deals, but wasn't part of the team that actually made the decision. So, and then what happens after a deal,
that
right?
I was wondering, this is your second situation where you're the after story, like the deal's done and you're working from there. When you were putting those deals together, were you kind of like, I helped create this.
Definitely.
And someone else is going to have all the fun.
Absolutely. And that was a big part of deciding to make the change, was to be maybe even more embedded in those companies and in their journeys. And so, again, as you know, I was at a smaller company, AGA Medical, here based in Minnesota. Actually, most of my career has been in Minnesota. AGA Medical had helped take them public, did investor relations, business development, got acquired about a year in by St. Jude Medical, another legacy name here in Minnesota.
Absolutely.
And stayed there 7 years doing investor relations. And journey-wise and curiosity-wise, that's how I made my path really to strategy. They started me in communications and then marketing, and I had all these different roles that eventually led me to a strategy role. And along the way, strategy and corporate development are pretty inextricably linked. And then I got acquired again. Abbott came and acquired St. Jude Medical, and then I had the chance to lead that integration into Abbott and then joined Zimmer Biomet, which is where I met you.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, had just a great experience helping drive growth and executing a portfolio transformation with M&A and the spin-off that I did there of dental and spine. And then found the perfect opportunity, I think, for, again, now being on the other side of a spin. So I've actually been the parent who has spun. I haven't actually been part of a spin on the NewCo side. So that was a great opportunity to, again, kind of just try something new and learn something different.
I hadn't really thought of the zigzag element about that. So talk about your chief strategy officer role at Solventum. And what is strategy mean? I mean, I would imagine most medtech folks think they have a role in strategy, the senior right. executives in particular. How does the chief strategy officer fit into Solventum's overall leadership?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think strategy means so many different things to so many people. But for me, my remit is really around making sure we're focused on long-term sustainable revenue growth. So as part of that, I oversee the work we do in making strategic choices and in just identifying those opportunities to grow, particularly externally. So on my team specifically, I have a corporate strategy function, which is the function that would do strategic planning annually, work across the enterprise, and we look at portfolio from an enterprise lens in terms of resource allocation. Then I also have a business strategy team, where different leaders are embedded with the businesses, but they report into me, so there's that connection back to the center. But they are definitely in there making those strategic choices, where to play, how to win, all of that inside with the businesses as they make kind of lower level, business level resource allocation decisions.
Are those folks merely reporting the results to you, or are they giving you input that then is ultimately part of the final decision? Are you?
Absolutely both. Yeah. I mean, it is very much part of the process. That's the biggest benefit of having a strategy leader, and we have strategy and business development leaders combined. The biggest benefit of having that function in two seats, if you will, mm-hmm. is that you do get that continuous cycle of just visibility, and you can iterate more quickly.
Do most companies give strategy enough attention or enough thought or enough foresight? I'm not looking for anyone for you to throw anyone under a bus, but I think we all go about our day thinking we're thinking strategy, but are we really sitting down and like looking at the big picture?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I've been lucky in where I've been, so I've you know, limited experience, but in the experience I have, I certainly think we've been spending a lot of time. I think we're structured to spend a lot of time in strategy, and I would have said the same about our Zimmer Biomet, where we were spending time on strategy. Now, the question really is, what is the work you're actually doing? That's probably where it differs, because there's all kinds of things. Again, people say strategy, and it could be all kinds of different roles. But for me, it's really about the team that is doing the work, looking at the markets we're in, the sub-markets we're in, the opportunities we have, the competitive landscapes, and then helping inform the decisions, where you make your investments, you prioritize your investments organically and inorganically.
And is that decision, that strategic decision, is it top-down, this is what we've decided, here you go, business unit, or is it very much we've worked all together to come up with this vision of what our strategic move forward is?
Yeah, I would say mostly at the business level. So you would, at the end of the day, I feel very strongly that businesses should own those decisions, but they need to do so in a way that connects back to corporate goals. But you would never see a situation where I said, we are going to do this R&D program, right? That wouldn't work, in my opinion. For us, it would be the business who's doing the work in partnership with how we sort of standardize how we look at markets. How do we force rank markets? How do we look at targets? How do we force rank targets? But ultimately, the business needs to own that decision.
Interesting. Well, I think we'll unpack that a little bit more later on. But let's focus now on the spinouts, the action of a spinout and what it does for company culture. What's the best way to manage through a spinout? I guess we'll let's take it from Solventum's perspective, since you are the spun out.
I'm the spun out.
What does that? Where do you go from there?
So just in terms of what the experience is when it first happens, I just want to make sure I captured.
Yeah, what's the best way to manage after having been spun out from a property?
Well, I think it's probably two things. It's acknowledging that these are hard. So, right, whenever you're going to disentangle from a parent, it is a lot of work. But the reason you can manage through that, if you're transparent and open about it, is because it is really energizing. It is incredibly energizing for a what was formerly a division to feel like they can chart their own path, and it's a new path. So I think when you do spin, what you need to do really quickly is sort of catalyze your new mission, your new values, your new strategy, where are you going, that end state vision, and really make sure everyone is clear and understanding of that, because that's the biggest benefit you have as a new independent company. You kind of get to chart your own destiny.
So is that determined prior to the spinning out? Do you day one, you have a playbook in hand?
Yeah, usually with a spin, at least in the ones that I've been involved with, there's a lot of time leading up to it. The question probably becomes how far in advance of that journey you've hired your leadership team. So the earlier you can hire a CEO and some of the new co folks that will be joining, the easier it is to have already established your mission. For Solventum, that is the case. So on day one, the team was very much aligned on mission, values, who we're trying to be, all of that work. But then you get to kind of really celebrate it on that day one.
So let's talk about Solventum. Introduce us to Solventum. Tell us a bit about the business.
Yeah, so I love the question because when I told people I was joining Solventum, people would go, where? And then I would say, oh, it's the spin out of 3M Health. And everyone would go, oh, okay, I know that company. So so we're still getting our name out there, but the name, I'll start with the name actually because I love this part of the story. So Solventum was, it's really the combination of two words. It's solving and it's momentum, which I think is really cool. And solve what matters is a big part of our values. And then just that idea of the momentum we have around continuing to bring forward breakthrough innovation, right? And what I really like is when we, what we call our employees are solvers, which I think is a really cool way to talk to you about your employees.
Sure.
It's like every day you're reminded, oh, I'm here actually not just to identify issues or challenges, I'm here to solve problems. And that is very much embedded in what I've seen in the culture. 3+ months in, it's very clear that this is a team of people who just really want to solve, and I love that.
No, that's the message we always impart on people who are doing webinars with us or just telling their stories. Like, what's the problem you're trying to solve? Like, just focus on that.
And solve it, right? So I don't just identify it, but come up with a solution to solve it. That's how I usually end that sentence.
Absolutely. So talk a bit, though, about the business lines. What are you putting out into the world?
Absolutely. So we the beauty of coming out of 3M is that you're a year old, but you have this incredible legacy, long history of just a lot of technology and capabilities that we have. So think of, you know, material science, data science, health science. I mean, there's a lot of that embedded inside this company. And we have four business segments. We have a MedSurg business, which when you look at that in at a next level, you would see kind of wound care, surgical solutions, and infection prevention. We have a dental business focused on core restoratives and call it digital orthodontics. We've got health information systems, which is really around driving efficiency and billing, coding, analytics, actually serving most hospitals, and CMS is a big customer. And then we've got our purification and filtration business, which, as the name would suggest, they provide advanced filtration and purification to a number of industries, so biopharmaceutical, med tech, industrial manufacturing, and earlier this year we announced the divestiture of that business to Thermo Fisher Scientific.
And I would imagine establishing the company culture of a healthcare-oriented business from a non-healthcare-oriented business is easier than other spin-outs. I think we in medtech and healthcare already have a very strong sense of self, and if you're in a business that serves medical devices and a company that has a lot of divisions that don't, those of us who do the medical device industry already have a very strong bond and a strong feeling, I think, that we do something different.
Yeah, I completely agree. I actually think that if you are a mission-centric person, just if you're looking for a purpose, there's almost no better place to be than healthcare. And inside of healthcare, my whole career has been similarly. I love medtech.
And I know you were the spinner at Zimmer. But I'm just wondering how the energies compare. Like, so what is it like for life of a company where a part has gone on to be a different company? Is there that looks neat and new and I want to be part of that? What is the culture like in the entity left behind, or the entity that the larger entity that remains?
So I can speak to, so at Zimmer Biomet, I think you the benefit of that for us was couple things. I think it's increased focus, right? It's you can make better resource allocation decisions, and quite frankly, you know that there is a better owner and a better opportunity for that spun business outside of your organization. So that's kind of a win-win. On the spin side, now that I'm living it, I really do see and feel that energy
and excitement around the opportunity to, again, chart your own path. You can really make decisions that impact your business in a way that you can't as being a division of a larger company, because at the end of the day, they get to make those resource allocation decisions. And if you really want to focus on innovation, resources matter a lot.
So talk a bit about Solventum's vision for the future after the spinoff. Where do we see this going?
So very focused on our mission, so enabling, you know, better, smarter, safer healthcare to improve lives. You'll hear that everywhere and all the time. I think the vision for how we get there is embedded in what we call our three strategic pillars. So what needs to be true inside of our organization? Who do we need to be able to really achieve our mission sustainably? And so we talk a lot about being a best and preferred place to work. And so why does that matter? I tell people all the time, companies don't really do anything. Solventum as an entity is not doing anything. It's the over 20,000 solvers that we have every day that have to do something. So if you don't have an engaged and excited workforce that really feels connected to your mission and feels like they can bring them their authentic selves to work every day and feels how what the work they do connects to that mission, you really will never sustainably achieve your mission, which is helping more and more patients. So that would be one. Second one we talk a lot about is being a trusted partner. And that sounds like, oh, you know, what does that really mean? It sounds kind of fuzzy, but I would tell you there are clear metrics you can track on all of these. That would say we want to make sure that, of course, we want to win by helping more people, but we want to do it in the right way. So you, in MedTech, as an example, you need to be a trusted partner for regulators to say, okay, I know you're bringing this innovation, but is it the highest quality? Has it been tested? You know, all the things that you would want a regulator to believe you care about greatly and do every day. Government agencies, you know, just even your solvers. I mean, everyone, just with customers, you're bringing in innovation. Are you actually solving a problem for me? Are you gonna get me the product on time, right? All of those kinds of things you can measure and track and make sure you're making progress against. And then the third pillar we talk about a lot would be being a top quartile performer. And the reason that matters is as a newly public company, we have investors that we want to make sure when they make decisions about where to put their dollars, we would like some of those to go into Solventum, and therefore we need to make sure they think we're an attractive investment opportunity. And then the other part of top quartile performer that's very aligned to delivering value for investors is also around just the financial health of the company. I tell people, a lot of people want to talk mission, but you can't do mission if you don't have a strong financial profile, right? You've got this, if you're not driving revenue growth, that's the engine that then generates earnings, which is just money you use to reinvest back so you can invest in innovation and programs and all the things you want to do with those resources to then drive more revenue growth to impact more people. So I think all of that connects back to that, I call it financial health virtuous cycle, but all of that is what matters. So I think where we're going is if we achieve and do what we think we can do, people should be able to very clearly, with data, show that we are a best and preferred place to work, a trusted partner, and a top quartile performer.
So open, if you would, your playbook. And I know when we talked earlier, we spoke of a three-phase transformation plan. What is that? What are the three phases, where you are in the process, and where does that plan get you?
Yeah, and probably not surprising, I think a spin or really any new place where you come in, maybe even a new leadership team, you have to start by where I said before, which is capturing hearts and minds, right? It's that idea of if your team isn't there, you know, you're never going to get anywhere. So phase one is really about stabilizing that and building that foundation. So capturing hearts and minds, and that's everything from mission, values, and then showing how you live it. We actually have mission ceremonies at Solventum, where you go around the world and you talk about the patients and people get a medallion to show, have something tangible that shows that they've been to a mission ceremony, and it helps just build that culture of connection to the mission. So that's phase one. That never really stops, though. So I tell
people... That wasn't present before with 3M. That wasn't part of the...
Hard to know. I wasn't there. Yeah, okay. But that's all new. So yeah. What I just described, that idea of mission ceremonies and just the new vision, the new mission, all of those things, that's all that's all new and has been a huge part of the work that's gone on over the last, you know, in their first year as an independent, our first year as an independent company. And but it doesn't stop. So when we talk about three phases, we should probably be careful because it's not like one stops and then the next one starts. You'll always be focused on making sure you're capturing hearts and minds. Second phase, it really is where we think about enhancing our strategic clarity, right? That strategy component. It's hard to do strategy if you don't have the right foundation. So you kind of got to start with that, make sure people are connected, and then you pretty quickly need to start pivoting into, okay, we know what our mission is, we know the businesses we're in, how do we drive that strategic clarity? What are the most highest growth opportunities, the most attractive opportunities inside of our portfolio? And that's a lot of the work that's been done over probably the last, 6 to 9 months or so, has really been just enhanced strategic clarity, identifying the most important growth drivers in our portfolio, because then you can make sure most of your resources are going to that. So that's probably phase two. And then phase three, which we're just really kicking off now, is around optimizing for growth. So as most spins do, we came out with a fair amount of debt, so you are capital constrained, but the purification and filtration divestiture really does, once it's closed, unlock the opportunity for us to accelerate and optimize our portfolio by adding on acquisitions and other opportunities that will allow us to really just accelerate growth for the organization.
So how do you make the decisions about which areas that you divest and which areas you invest in?
So we've gone through a process through strategic planning where we really use a consistent framework to look at, first of all, the markets. So you come in, you have this large diversified portfolio, and then you have to start saying, okay, what are all the markets we're actually in? Which, maybe sounds easy, but you actually have to do the work to look across and understand not just the markets at their highest level, but the sub-markets inside of those. So we've spent a lot of time doing the work, and we've created a framework that looks at things like market attractiveness, which really is, is there an opportunity to improve patient care in that market, right? Are there unmet needs that still exist? Is it large? Is it growing? What's the reimbursement? Are there barriers? So there's a whole list of things that we would look at to score it. Then you'd look at, okay, do we have a right to be in that market? So strategic fit, what kind of technology capabilities, what call points do we have looking across the patient care continuums for the places that we already are, and seeing how many of those boxes we check. And then I call the third bucket, if you will, I call it actionability, which really just means, is there a path to leadership, right? What are the competitive dynamics? If they're already really entrenched big players and you don't see a clear path to leadership, maybe that isn't the right opportunity. Or what is the IP landscape? I think there was a session earlier on IP. I mean, that's an important consideration for sure when you're going into a market. So those are the kinds of things, and we literally do the research, primary research, to figure out each of our markets and our sub-markets, and then you rank them and you go do the work.
Are you able to say whether there are other properties you may divest, or is the divesting done?
I would never in any company ever say that it's done. I would say this was a very large divestiture for us, and of course that is what we're focused on right now, and the rest of where we're focused is really just trying to understand the areas inside of the rest of our business that we should invest in. Mm-hmm. I would never say never, because who knows, but that's not where we're focused at all right now.
Well, let's talk about the other side then, the M&A. What's your decision criteria for acquiring a business?
So I start with markets, because I think, again, if you're not in the right market, it doesn't really matter what the target is. It could be a really attractive target. But so we've started with all the work we've done around markets, and then we've said, okay, within those markets, what are the right targets? And the way we've looked at that is probably a different framework, but a similar framework, which would be around finding those that are best strategic fits. And so what do I mean when I say that for us? I would say we're looking for opportunities, of course, in higher growth markets where we have a right to win. But it would also be things like, is it differentiated technology? Is it breakthrough? Is it something that's protected? Because that is the kind of revenue stream that we know is more durable and more lasting than something that isn't. So that's a kind of, when I think about the weightings inside of some of these categories, that's a big one. Does it, do we have a call point already there? Are there synergy opportunities? And I mean, like, growth synergy opportunities as well. So if we have a call point and they can sell it, that's obviously a higher score than if we have to go out and build. Financial impact matters too. Again, I talk a lot about the need for us to accelerate growth. So we're going to be very focused on opportunities to drive revenue growth, but that doesn't mean at any price. So it also has to achieve, you know, attractive return metrics. We look at things like ROIC, like I'm sure most acquirers do. And then the last thing I talk about is, again, I'll be back to actionability, but here it's, is the company interested in being acquired, right? Because I, you know, you can't make someone, I always tell people, like, you can't make someone marry you. So they aren't in the place where they want to have that conversation, then of course we wouldn't do that. I think finding the right target at the right time when someone's ready at the right valuation is actually a fairly challenging thing to do, and which is why I know I am always focused on building a broader pipeline.
Hearing all that, if you were to close on a deal, I'm curious as to whether the deals you're looking at would fit nicely into what you currently do, or is there a deal on your list of things I'd like to do, deals I'd like to do, that would make us all go, whoa, like that's, I'm sure there's an adjacency to a business you're already doing, but it's a completely different product line.
Yeah, I think there's always opportunities and companies should be open to looking at it. I think for us, I'll never say never, but I think from a focus area right now, we've got such a great portfolio to look through that I think it could be in any of our portfolios, by the way. So post the divestiture, that's across a very large MedSurg platform as well as dental and health information systems. So all on the table, which gives me a pretty broad opportunity as it sits. So it probably anything we're in or adjacent to that where there's, you know, an opportunity to build, but a completely new white space, probably at least not in the near term.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the data business and the work you do with CMS. There's a lot of transformation going on at the federal government with a lot of the agencies. Are you feeling ripples at Solventum? Do you anticipate some changes to that business? Has it created any new sort of risk factors or circumstances that you need to be considering that you didn't quite consider, or is it pretty much the ship is still sailing straight ahead?
I mean, I think, of course, in these times, everyone should be looking at impacts, et cetera. But no, I don't see anything specific there. I mean, again, what we're doing is really driving efficiency in hospitals and particularly focused on things like revenue cycle management and things that people want and need. So I don't think there's something specific there that I would call out.
Interesting. So, and I know I've seen a lot of partnerships recently that you're entering to address specific challenges. Define a partnership and how are you approaching partnerships and how are you evaluating those opportunities?
Yeah, so partnerships to me are quite different than acquisitions. So it's a great question. I think partnerships can be a great opportunity to develop true innovation faster than maybe you can, but would on your own. But they really only work if both sides are truly bringing something different to the table. So that would be something I look for. If there's truly an unmet need, which would be something else I would look for. And if both sides can win. So what do I mean by that? I mean that in an acquisition, you are kind of paying for the right to make all the decisions. That's the way it is. They come into your fold, you make the decisions, and you go. In a partnership, not to go back to my marriage analogy, but I will because it is a marriage, right? It is something where both sides, there's a constant in the ebb and flows of innovation. There will be many ups and downs. And there will be times that both of them have to kind of come back to the table and have another conversation about it. So I think a partnership can be great, but it really does have to be a situation where both sides can win. And sometimes when you have a larger company and a smaller company or two, they just have different agendas. Mm-hmm. So I think they're great. I think we have some good examples. You know, you mentioned we'd done some recently. I could call out Sprint Ray as one that I think has been a great example. I don't know if you've seen that one. Sprint Ray is a 3D printing company in the dental space that we announced a partnership probably, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. And it's a good example because they what they bring is 3D printing, which we don't have. And what we bring in our dental business is really strong material science, right? So we can make great materials, right, which would matter in a 3D printer. So think of it, I don't know, if you ever had a crown? I have, so I'll own that,
no.
I'll tell you. So anyone who's had a crown? Anyone had a crown? I see some nodding heads. Great, okay. So let me give you sort of how this would play out if this partnership achieves all of its goals, which I fully expect it to do. But so today you go, you show up your dentist, they do their work, they end up giving you a temporary crown. Then you've got to wait a couple weeks, they bill it, you come back. So I will fully admit that I am a patient who is a lot of anxiety and fear around dental procedures. So for me,
that's so strange.
I know. Well, someone looking on your mouth while you're awake, it's just not fun. So I do have some fear there. And I remember the process. So what would happen here in this partnership, the idea is they have these 3D printers that sit in the office. And someone gave me the example, think of it like an espresso machine, where you go and you put your pod in and out comes your espresso.
Oh, cool.
This is gonna be a capsule or a pod of our materials that would then go into that 3D printer, and we have strong enough science that it's actually will give you the longevity of a permanent crown.
Wow.
So it's one trip to the dentist, and that's great for the patient, of course. It's also great for the dentist who now has that second appointment available to continue to help somebody else, right? So that to me is a great example of clearly different capabilities and clearly an unmet need. And we've worked together, I think, really well to make sure that both sides feel like they're winning in that partnership. So that'd be a good example.
Is that a piece of equipment that is not currently sold to dental offices?
No, it is today.
Okay.
The 3D printer is what they had in their current situation was they just didn't have the same longevity. So they can print a crown,
but
they're looking for one that is more permanent, more robust, more comprehensive. So we're the partner there.
I apologize. No, that makes more sense. So you're the supplier to this potentially very large distributed product, medical product that could get out to a lot of dentists' offices.
Right. Yeah,
that's a lot of anxiety.
And we bring the material science to them. So again, it's a win-win.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
So, how should we look at Solventum going forward, and how should we measure success as you grow independently?
Awesome. So I think measuring success probably goes back to. You should measure us by the number of patients we're able to impact, right? As a mission-centric company, that's hard to measure. So I'd probably go back to, as you're looking at Solventum, are we a best and preferred place to work, a trusted partner, and a top quartile performer? Because those are things that have, you know, some data centricity, and I think will tell us if we're on our path. Because I do believe that without those achieving those three, it's really hard to deliver our missions sustainably. You can do it occasionally, but to do it durably and sustainably, I think you need all three.
You love the industry so much. Mm-hmm. You're now at the a founding member of what could potentially be a market leader going forward. What kind of excitement does, I mean, I don't want to overplay the excitement of MedTech, but I just think it would be very cool to be on the ground floor of a new MedTech leader. How does that drive you every day? And I guess what do you want Solventum to be 5 to 10 years? What would be? I know how we can measure success. We ask that question, but what do you want to see this be in 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I really do wake up, and this probably sounds, I don't know, like I made it up, but I swear it's true. I really do wake up and be like, oh my gosh, how great is it that there's this opportunity. Again, for a company that's only a year old, what does that mean? That means you have a real chance to make a huge impact because it's early. So I'm coming in right now and I'm creating frameworks I'm creating our first playbooks and processes and building a team. But I'm doing it on top of a company that's established and has been around for a really long time and has tremendous capabilities. That's a really rare opportunity in my mind. So I truly feel very grateful to have the opportunity. And then in terms of what I would like to see, I would personally like to know that I've helped charter the ship and that we're executing, particularly on the growth side. So a lot of the work I do is around accelerating growth. And I think with the markets we're in, we're still a low single-digit company growth, low single-digit growth today. I think with the markets we're in and the strategy we're charting and the work we're doing and the investments we're making, there's no reason we can't be a much higher growth company, which will just, again, help us fill that engine and be able to do amazing things for patients. So that's why I'm excited.
That would get me up in the morning as well.
Yeah.
So that's a great story. All right, Rachel, thank you for sharing your story today.
Thanks for having me very much.
Great.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again, everyone who joined us at Device Talks Minnesota. It was great time. We look forward to being back next year. I hope you'll join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. You can go to west.devicetalks.com to register for that. Our early bird rate will be expiring in mid-July, and we are posting details on the program very soon. So I'll be posting some things on LinkedIn as well, including I posted last week that Tim Schmidt of Johnson & Johnson MedTech will be our opening keynote conversation. So that's a wrap, folks. Again, join us on Tuesday, July 8th for a great presentation by Maxon called Robotic Joints and Haptics. That'll be led by Kayleen Brown. Please do subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of our MedTech-oriented podcast. And of course, we would love it if you would follow us on LinkedIn. Follow me, Tom Salemi. Follow Kayleen Brown. Follow Chris Newmark. Or follow Sean Hooley. And of course, make sure you've liked our Device Talks page and liked Mass Device as well. We'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. Give us a rating, if you would, on your podcast player so folks know how much you like the show. All right, that's it, folks. Thanks again. Once again, happy July 4th to you all. I hope you have a great holiday and look forward to reconnecting with you in a couple of weeks.